Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Sharp Tongue Podcast. I'm your girl, Jessie Mae Peluso. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate you coming back to another week of the Sharp Tongue Podcast. This is going to be another grief survival guide episode. I believe we are on part 14. We had part 13 last week. I decided to do another one because it's been a couple weeks since we've added to our grief survival guide. So this is that. But before that, if you guys are in upstate New York, come see me live. My wide open tour continues. We are going to be in Poughkeepsie, New York, October 29th and 30th at Laugh It Up. In I've never been there, so I'm excited. I've been to Poughkeepsie, I just have never performed at this club before. So if you know anybody in the tri-state area, tell them to come out. It's going to be a fun time with me, Marty Caproni, a couple other locals are going to show up and sling some jokes for you guys. It's going to be a great time. Poughkeepsie, New York, October 29th and 30th. Then I have to tell you, I'm kind of excited. I got invited to be a VIP guest for Tony Robbins. Yes, humble brag, I'm a VIP guest of Tony Robbins. That's one of the reasons we had to move our girl date. Carly and I had a date November 13th for our girl tour to continue, and I had to move it because Tony Robbins called, and you know, I call myself Bony Robbins, so it's a sign from the universe that I am meant to embark on this journey with Mr. Robbins. Also, it's November 13th is the year anniversary of my mother's death, so it's kind of a little serendipitous that it's happening on that weekend. And I feel like it's just a sign for me to do a little, you know, step out of my comfort zone and then step on to some hot coals. I'm excited about it. But Carly and I will be continuing our girl tour. Come see us live together in Austin, Texas, the 18th, 19th, and 20th of November. We will be having a live podcast recording on the 20th of November. That's at the Creek in the Cave in Austin, Texas, that weekend, 18th, 19th, and 20th of November. And then the first weekend of December, I'm going to be in Plano, Texas at the House of Comedy, the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And then I will be at the Mall of America at the House of Comedy there, December 16th, 17th, and 18th. And the wide open tour will commence. Well, it will end. It commenced in July or August, and it's ending in Syracuse on New Year's Eve. Oh my God, my hometown. We're wrapping it up full circle. We're going to be at the Funny Bone in Carousel Mall, aka Destiny USA, which it will not always be known as because I grew up and it was Carousel Mall because there's a big ass carousel. Okay. I don't know if Foot Locker is many people's destiny, but a carousel, absolutely. That's where children's dreams go to turn green because of the gangrene left over from Green Lakes. Sorry. I have taken an edible. It has kicked in. Don't judge me. That's rude of you to do that. Please don't judge me. This will be the last date, December 31st, New Year's Eve. I was going to say the Mall of America. Carousel Mall, Syracuse, New York, wrapping up the wide open tour there. Come hang out with us. It's going to be a blast. A lot of opportunities to still see me live on the road through the end of the year before I come off the road for a little bit. So check that out. And as always, if you want to watch the podcast, go to YouTube. Subscribe to my page, youtube.com/JessieMaePeluso. Tell your friends, click like and share. You can watch the videos there. Leave a comment below when you watch the videos so we know how you're liking it and what other guests you'd like to see, any other subject matter, anything you guys would like to contribute as a option for the podcast. I'm open for. I really am open to hearing what you guys want to listen to me talk about and with whom. And speaking about who I'm talking about and what I'm talking about and with whom, this is a Grief Survival Guide episode 14. This is Riding the Grief Train with one of my dear friends. She has been through so much, just like I have. Her and I kind of bonded through our subsequent losses with our fathers, and she's an amazing comedian. She's so funny, and I hope you guys enjoy this Grief Survival Guide episode with the one and only Nicole Amy Schreiber. That's right. She's got like four names. Sharp Tongue Podcast. Beep, 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 beep.
You're listening to the Sharp Tongue Podcast. I'm your host, Jessie Mae Peluso.
It's a personal
look. Well, it's not really a look because it's a podcast. I'm already fucking this up.
This is kind of like
a verbal comedy diary, a deep look into the crevices of my mind. It's going to get dirty. You might cry. You probably laugh. Hopefully you'll laugh. The whole point is for you to laugh, but you also might cry. I talk about my family. I talk about farts. I talk about love, loss, comedy, how hard it is to make it in this biz. I'm a fucking professional. Each week it's something different. Sometimes I have a guest host. Sometimes it's going to be a movie companion episode. Sometimes I just ramble about the bullshit I dealt with the week before. You never know what you're going to get. It's raw, uncut, and funny. It's me.
I just had a genius idea to start doing First Five for Sharp Tongue because my sister just sent me an audio message. Let's see. Right here.
Hey, do you remember how mom and dad met? Was like at a bar or something? I'm just trying to think of how they met. Anyways. Ciao.
Ciao. And she's so cute. We sound exactly alike. And here's my response.
Mom and dad met in a bar in Mattydale. And dad gave her a line from behind. It sounded terrible. But it's one of the podcast episodes where mom talked about it because I asked her that. But she said dad said some stupid line like, if the front looks half as good as the back, I'm in luck. And she slept with him that night.
What? Posthumous facts with your parents. They're dead, but new facts aren't. Your parents might be dead, but here's some new shit you never knew. Oh, I see Deb's in the chat. So now Debbie and I have gotten smart where we're figuring out how to do things to be more efficient. And so normally Debbie will watch the podcast after and, you know, cut clips from that. But now she's just going to be in the episodes with us. So from time to time, I may force her to pop in and interject, and she might, you know, have to call me out on some bullshit. So Deb is in the mix with us, and we're just currently waiting for our guest this week, who every time I see her, she comments on this adorable size of my head. She says I have the most perfect shaped head ever. And I think that's like a compliment that's that could fall in the line of what a serial killer might say. But she doesn't have serial killer vibes, but she definitely has the face of a woman who could murder. And I mean that. With all due respect, truthfully, you know, I talk about it in my stand-up about the murder percentage in the world and how that's the real discrepancy with equality between men and women, because men are just better at it. And we got to get better at it, ladies, is really what's got to happen. We got to make these motherfuckers scared. That should be our goal. Our goal should be to have them be afraid of us. You know, we've been raised to apologize to men, and we wonder why the murder rate is 90% homicide due to male murder. And we really have to, flip those numbers. That's my goal. That would be my campaign if I were a president. I would really, you know, to figure out how to achieve equality, I would start a campaign. You know, I wouldn't want the women to storm the Capitol. I would want women to storm their boot camp classes to create the muscles they'll need to actually murder men. And that's how we're going to get, you know, solve this whole equality issue. I see our guest is here. So I am going to say goodbye, and you guys who are going to listen to the podcast will see the rest of the podcast. Hey.
I mean, Jessamay fucking Peluso.
You are so studious and adorable. I can't even fucking handle it.
Am I studious?
You're studious. And you know what? You have, I was saying before you got in, that you have the face of somebody who could literally be like a serial killer, but as a compliment, because you look like you have some secrets. And then I got onto this whole diatribe how I've been talking about women needing to straighten out that murder statistic. But
coming from someone who has a perfectly shaped head. Have you ever talked about that on your podcast? Do your fans know how perfectly shaped your circular head is? Like, I've never in my life I've had observation. And I observe heads. That's what I do. I've never seen anyone with a head quite like yours. By the way,
I actually just mentioned it. I didn't mention how you embrace my head every time I see you like this. Mm-hmm. You go like this, and like, you kiss like me on my forehead.
You I feel like I'm reading me? You. I read you. That's how I take in your energy through your globe.
You put your mouth, your whole face goes here, and you're sniffing here, and then you give me the lightest peck on my forehead, and I feel coddled. I literally, it's very maternal of you.
I want to cuddle. That's the closest I'm going to get to being a mom is coddling.
It's coddling
your perfectly shaped head.
That's hilarious. I can I talk about a revelation you discussed in your dating life when I saw you at where did I just see you? The Laugh Factory.
Laugh Factory, yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
The gay one. Is it my gay dating?
Yeah, you're gating. So you're gating now.
Am I gating? I was gating. I was gating. I'm done gating.
So was it your first gate?
That was my first gate. It wasn't my first time hooking up with a girl, but it was my first gate.
Wow. And how, like, I think women are beautiful. I appreciate them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I never say never, but I'm so ferociously hetero that I really, in my mind, even if there were just two women left on the planet, mm-hmm. I honestly think that I would just be platonic with her.
No, how you would pick the one who's more masculine. If there were just two people left, you would maybe be like, who has more masculine energy? And then you just gravitate towards that person because you couldn't just not have physical, like if you're a sexual physical being, you're a sexual physical being. And if you're left with two options, you're going to pick one.
I think you might be right. Maybe the woman with the longer clit, but I don't know. Because I function asexually very well.
By the way, me too. Oh, yeah, totally.
Have you ever had a year of abstinence?
1,000. I've had 2 years.
Oh, wow. Isn't it great?
It's not. It's so funny. It's not like it never registered. It was just what I was doing. And by the way, that 2 years of abstinence came after I kissed a girl in a bar. I made out with this girl at a bar in San Diego. And then after that, I drove home shook, did not know what to do. Cried the whole way home. Not because I was like, oh no, I was like freaking out about being gay. I was just like, oh my God, this is why I've never had a successful relationship with a man. By the way, that came after a year and a half of me having like a very like fun fuck buddy relationship with Bill Dawes.
And oh, like, wow.
Yeah. Name and dropping. So, and okay. I'll name drop. I don't give a fuck.
I love it. I love it about
names
you.
Shall be named. Yes. So, and Bill didn't want anything with me. And there was like a point, I remember there's this one time he was over at my place and we had just, it was post coitus. And I hopped onto a dating app and he looked over and he goes, I'm sorry, are you on a dating app right now? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I'm right here. I was like, I'm sorry, you just want to fuck. He's like, don't tell me what I want. I was like, all right, well, I put the phone down. I was like, what do you want? Do you want a relationship? And he was like, and I was like, exactly. And I got back on the app and I just kept going. I was like, I'm looking for a relationship. If you can't give me that, cool. But let's not pretend like this is more than fucking. And that was kind of like the twist in it where I like had kind of to develop this like disappointment in like men where it's like, you can't even be an honest fuck buddy. You can't just fuck me and like be like, this is all it is. You have to have this whole guise of like, maybe mystery. And like, we are such suckers for mystery because we're like in that space between truth and lies is this mystery that like men love to live in. Not in all men, but
I think a lot of people do.
A lot of people do. But I do think it's like, I think that space as far as like men go, in my experience, has been a very white male space. Black men, any black guy I've ever dated is like, I like you, period. This is what it is. I want more. I want less. That's it. That's all. We're done. Cool. Goodbye. It's like so straightforward. Like there's no bullshit with black guys.
That's interesting. I wonder if it has to do with like just the disparity that exists between the cultures because men, white men traditionally have more options in a lot of different scenarios. And because they have more options, they like to live in that limbo where they're playing the chasing game, the cat and mouse thing. It sort of, I don't know why in my mind I'm picturing like a Skull Mason group.
I mean, yeah. Any white men, as far as the icon of their groups, it's a death symbol. White guys are just like, death, it's not that bad. Black guys are like, historically speaking, you have been murdering us. Let's stay away from that sort of scary imagery. Yeah, I mean, that's just been my experience. I don't know if there's fact to it. But so all of that thing happened with Bill. Then I go to San Diego. I do this show, Josh Nelson's show. Have you done that one?
Oh, yeah, so he's got like 50 of them. I just was on a boat last week with that guy.
Oh, amazing. And he always brings like the most basic of the basics. And you just like, you're just up there and you're just like, whatever you say, they're like, fuck yeah. And I got off stage and there was this girl there and she was like, oh my God, I love you. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. I love you. Like, I love you too. Like, fucking, fuck yeah, that was so much, such a fun show. And she's like, no, I love you. And I was like, I mean, I'm not gay. And she's like, I don't care. And I was like, okay. And then we just kind of hung out at the bar and we were like talking and talking and talking. And then eventually she was just like, I can't let you leave until I kiss you. And I was like, all right. And
did it happened? Feel like how when you kiss a guy for the first time, was it the same type of feeling?
Yes,
where you were
but more in that I'd never felt such a connection in my life. Like it was Whoa. Like magnetic.
Whoa.
And that's when I drove home crying because I was like, it's all been a lie. I've been fucking sitting on all these dicks all my life. And then there's just been this, I mean, it's just been a pussy that I've been looking for. And then I didn't hook up with anybody for like 2 years.
Because you were conflicted and confused?
Yeah, because I was like so confused. I remember I called Scout Durwood.
And I was Scout. Like, Scout. Yeah, she's a good open heart.
Yeah, she's a good open heart. So I called her and I was like, I think I'm gay. And she's like, switch your preferences on the dating apps. Try dating a woman. I switched my preferences. Did not match with one woman. And then Scout was like, they can smell the straight on you.
What does straight smell like? Like sliced meat? Canned tuna? What does it smell like? What does straight smell?
Straight.
I just imagine it smelling like
baby powder.
Yeah. Baby powder and like packaged turkey meat. Yeah. I think straight smell is just not, you know,
straight to packaged turkey meat. With all the nitrates, so like yes. not good quality turkey meat, so
no,
nitrate
Oscar
heavy
Mayer.
Turkey meat, and then a scent from Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, guys in the chat, in the comments below, tell us what you think straight smells like. I'd really love to hear your input. And so 2 years you were abstinent. I think the longest I went was like just about a year and a half.
Was there any impetus for it, or just that's
Yeah, there was a similar impetus where it was just me falling into this cyclical pattern of, you know, attracting a similar type that wasn't yielding any sort of healthy outcome. And yeah. I decided to try and grow my hymen back. And it doesn't matter how much fertilizer in that soil, it ain't coming back.
The hymen tree is a one-time tree.
It is a one-time tree, and you know, for me, it was a nice break.
By the way, when you had sex for the first time after the break, were you just like, "My pussy's gonna be so tight"?
I did, and it was, and it
lasted about a week.
It lasted like 5 seconds, and I was like, "Oh, okay." Now we're back to just being the cavern that it was. Yeah. But no, like all joking aside, I do have, and this isn't me trying to make Brad Pitt my husband, but I do have a relatively taut kitty box. So
do you?
I do. It's a gift and a curse.
How do you know? Because it's just are you constantly like, oh, it's too big?
I'm constantly clenching. I clench her all day long. I turn her into a vice, like a nice vice grip. It's something
How's
I work
your pelvic
on.
Pelvic floor. Can you do jumping jacks?
Oh yeah, the pelvic floor is solid. It's a concrete floor. I had it done on HGTV. It's You know, you could do everything. You could do box jumps. You could have like a step team perform on it and it won't fall through. You know, that video of the Indian wedding where everyone fell through? That's not my pelvic floor.
That's my pelvic floor. Yeah. My pelvic floor is lava. Okay. Like it is, it's its own spin off of The Floor is Lava. It's a new game show.
So you spend 2 years being abstinent, and then how far away are we from this rebirth into having sex? Are we like, what was the 2 year ago mark when you started having sex again?
When was that?
Like, was it within the past couple years? Like, have you been?
No, that was in 2017. 2017, 18.
So this is relatively recent.
Yeah. And I broke out of it because I did a comedy festival in New Orleans and there was another comic.
Fungal.
Fucking summer camp for comics. This comic was like, we should hook up. And I was like, no. And he was like, come on, let's go make out. It'll be fun. I was like, all right, we'll go make out. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to make out with this dude. And then I like grazed over his pants and it was just a fucking python.
Yeah, nice Olympic.
And
baton.
I was like, oh, well, that's going to have to go in all the holes. so I was just like, yeah, and then I just fucking, bon appetit, we destroyed an Airbnb in New Orleans. I'm fucking destroyed.
You definitely got charged a double room cleaning fee for that.
Oh, no question about it. He's like, I don't know if I ever got charged. He's like, because it was some other guys. He got the place with another comic and the comic put it on. He's like, but the comic never said anything to me. I was like, yeah, probably because your fucking friend who you shared the Airbnb with was just listening the whole night. And I was just fucking jerking it. And he was probably like, I did get off. So
yeah, well, I made out as well.
Yeah. But yeah, so then that happened. And then after that, I was just like, big dicks. I just love them so much. I miss them. I'll only have sex if it's a big dick.
You know, I don't fault you for that. I feel like, you know, as a woman, it's important to get what you want. Society has beat us down a little bit to make us believe that we are worth less than we desire and in what we are really worth. So I think going for the size it's a per person scenario. I say size does matter. I think there's nothing wrong with wanting to fill your womb and your baby maker hole with whatever you want to fill it with.
And it's interesting. You just said about, you know, we're taught to not, you know, we're not allowed to want the things we want. And then when we do, we're shamed for it because we're called things like, oh, you're a size queen. Like that's supposed to make us feel bad. And then if a woman wants a man who has money, she's a gold digger. Like if we want these things, like who doesn't want a man with money?
Right. And why is that so bad? So, I'm not a good person unless the other person that is in my relationship is struggling.
Yeah. I need to be with the underdog. I have to be with the underdog.
Right.
Also the idea that a woman wants to be with a man for money. Oh, you mean the system that men created? Where we had to stay at home and they went and made money and then we had to rely on them to exist in the world. And God forbid there's still a woman today that's like, I still want the man to be the one with the money.
Yeah. Why is that so bad? And I honestly think that system worked pretty good.
Yeah.
That system back in the day worked pretty fucking good.
Yeah. And if you don't like that system, great. If you do like that system,
fine.
Fine. By the women who do subscribe to that system, good for you. I'm a mouthy broad. That's never gonna work for me.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think I like the principles of the system. Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked about it a lot on stage. Like, you know, just wearing a cute dress and baking some brownies sounds pretty great. But then I'm also ambitious, so I'm in the middle. And you know, I think like that whole idea that women—it's such a good point. Like, so we're supposed to just go for the underdogs. That's all we're worthy of. And if we go for anybody who's at our level or above, now we're gold diggers.
Yeah. We have. There's a cute, slanderous name that goes with it.
Yeah. There's always some like just a jab, like just a little southern
slight jab. Oh, are you a gold digger? Well, no, I mean, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Yeah. I am. Cool. Call me whatever the fuck you want. However you want to spin it, go for it.
And it's really.
And by
just,
the way, I want someone to gold dig me.
Sure. Absolutely.
I want to have enough money that. Yes. I want to have enough money that I look over at the person that I'm with and I'm like, you are with me for the wrong reasons, and I'm here for it.
Right. Here's some lunch money. Now go down on me and leave by five.
Here's lunch money. Eat my lunch meat and then bounce. Okay.
Have fun with my Lunchable and please leave me alone.
Lunchable.
Wait, can we talk? So have you gone down on a vagina?
Okay.
I sound like such a novice, but it's like
recent one.
Wow. Just so you know, it's like it's outer space travel.
Okay. Have you looked at your vagina recently? Like, really looked at it?
I mean, I check her out like once a week just to make sure there's no critters, extra, you know, the barnacles. I mean,
but do you look into the barnacles? The visceral, the touchy barnacle on a pussy.
Yeah.
Just a callousy.
You're welcome.
Have you like looked at like fucking sat in front of a mirror, spread your puss and like looked in there?
Yes, I have.
I'm out.
I know.
I'm out. Before I went on my third date with this girl, I took a good hard look in the mirror at my own pussy for probably about like 10 minutes. And I was like trying to, I felt like it was just like, I was like trying to desensitize myself to the shock of it. Like, so that if I did go down on her when I pulled her pants down, I wouldn't be like, ah! And I just sat there looking at my pussy. I was like, there's absolutely no way I'm going to be able to look at this on another. Be like, snacky.
Well, that goes to my point of if there were two of us left on Earth, I'm so ingrained as a heterosexual being that I really just think I would find a real sweet spot of abstinence and, you know, like a coexisting life, but that would be it. Like I would more probably sit on a stump that fit me well than, you know, be involved physically with another woman. So that's why I was like so intrigued by what you were when you told me that at the Laugh Factory. I'm like, oh my God, tell me more. That's so interesting. Yeah. And also, like, I think it's great to live a full life and to take risks. You are definitely somebody who takes a lot of risks. And that being said, we do have to remind everybody, this is a part of our grief survival guide miniseries on Sharp Tongue Podcast, where we're interviewing people who've been through some tumultuous and tragic experiences in their life. And that brings me to this point, because I know you've been through a lot and we both had fathers who suffered with neurodegenerative diseases. If my first question before we get into all that is, having gone through that with your dad, do you think it made you more fuck it in life? Like more
totally.
Acquire more like fuck it attitude?
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
It's one of those things where it's like, how can you not watch on decay right in front of your eyes? Someone who you love more than anything. And there's literally nothing you can do. It's not like cancer where you're like, all right, we're going to fight this. You know, we're going to do this as much as we can. We're going to do this as much as we can. We've got this option and this option. Like, cancer is something where it's like, there are different viable routes to go with things.
There are options.
There's options. There's a fight to be had.
Yes. And hope.
And hope. There's a degree of hope. I mean, it all depends on what kind of cancer, but for the most part, there's every kind of cancer. If you have a complete outlier, you're fucked, but, every kind of cancer has been seen before, sort of thing, even though every case of cancer is different. There's never one that's the same, but they're all, generally speaking, you can do treatments. Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, you're just fucked. Any neurodegenerative disease. It's like, you can take this, it'll minimize your symptoms to a degree. You can get this surgery, it'll stave off the symptoms for this period of time. But ultimately, you're going to die a fucking vegetable. And it's just a very hard thing to watch. And it's a very hard thing to watch someone, like, I don't know what your dad was like, but my dad was like a fucking man's man. My dad was just a fucking man of truck loving, car fixing, teach your daughter to change a tire, know the difference between, you know, transmission and oil, like just a blue collar man.
Yeah.
And to watch that be taken, to someone's manliness be taken away from them. My dad wasn't any less of a man, but he wasn't able to express himself in the ways that he had his entire life.
Yeah, and that's so hard to watch. That was
like, that's so hard to watch. And it's like, for that reason, I'm like, fuck it all. Fuck it all.
That's exactly how I felt through the whole process, is like, you just, because you're a sweet person, you are a genuine person, especially in this industry, you know, you stand out as a beam of light. So that can, you know, going through what you went through, what I went through, that can rob, that experience can rob you and start to deplete that light. But and on the other sense of it, you can also come out with this fuck it all attitude,
yeah,
which combined with being a beam of light and a good person, it's really, it's almost a silver lining in all of it.
Yeah.
You know, so bring me back to when you started noticing things going wrong with your dad. Like, for my experience, my listeners know, it sort of came out of nowhere, but also had been, in hindsight, we were like, oh, this has been going on for decades. We just didn't know what it was.
Yeah. I mean, my dad's dad had Parkinson's. So we were well versed with what Parkinson's looked like. And my dad was in his mid-50s probably, and we started to kind of like notice there's, in Parkinson's, it's called the narrowing of your gait when you walk. So like most human beings, when they walk, you walk with your feet a certain distance apart, and your feet walk side by side. Sometimes you're, you know, pigeon-toed or duck-footed, but like either way, you've got some space in between your feet. With Parkinson's, your feet start to come closer together. That's why the tripping and falling is a thing. So my dad started having a narrowing gait ever so slightly, and he stopped moving one of his arms when he walked. He would only swing one arm when he walked. And that is also, I can't remember what the name for it is, but that is also a symptom of Parkinson's. And my mom's a doctor. So my mom was like, not only has she like knows about it medically, but we all had seen my grandfather go through it. My grandfather went through it late in life, and mid-50s is, I mean, it's not Michael J. Fox young, but it's young. So it's, there were all those things happening. And then
so that was in his mid-50s when those symptoms started to come about?
When those symptoms started to come about. And it was like one of those things where we're all like, maybe it's Parkinson's. Yeah, it's probably Parkinson's. And we were all just like, TikTok, let's just wait and find out if it's officially Parkinson's. And then I think he was officially diagnosed at like 57 or 58. That was eight. He died a year ago yesterday.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you so much. It was 18 years that he, since his diagnosis, pretty much. And what's crazy, this will give you the chill too. So October 18th, 2010, he had the brain stem surgery that they do for Parkinson's patients, where they basically put a pacemaker onto your brain. They do it while you're awake. They put you in this halo. They grid your head through like MRI technology. It's fascinating what they do. Anyhow, and then they install electrodes into your brain, and it basically turns the clock back like 7 years. And they say that surgery, if done well, can give a patient 10 extra years. Not good years, but 10 extra years. They estimate about 7 more good years. That was October 18th, 2010, and he died October 18th, 2020.
Oh my God.
10 years, just literally to the day.
You know, you think about doing things like that off of a conversation of you explaining, and people who may or may not know that these diseases are incurable. Mm-hmm. You're literally buying time in... Mm-hmm. You know, there's even a moral dilemma with that for me of, you know, obviously it's a conversation that can be had with a family, like, well, what are we going to do? What are our options? Because at that point, when you're facing something like that, of course you want to keep them alive. They want to stay alive. Most people want to stay alive for the most part, you know, that the will given up comes at the time where the time is right for that person, and only they can know that. But for the most part, people have fight in them, and all of it is selfish. The person who wants to stay alive, the people who are surrounding them, it's not a bad thing to have that sort of selfishness. But for me, there was always the conversation in the back of my head, like, because my father had become incapacitated. It's like, well, how much more can we do? Mm-hmm. What more that we do is it, how is that even going to promise us something beyond, yeah, you know,
who or what are we keeping this person in this state for?
Right.
Because we don't want them to die. No, we don't want anybody to die because we don't want them to suffer. They've already suffered. So it's like, how much more suffering is worth it or not worth it? Like, it's just, it really is. It's, there is absolutely no grace in any of it.
There's no grace, and there's, it's just the dignity that depletes from them. You know, their dignity is just stripped going through this, just as you know, like the, all the processes that shut down, and then the ways to compensate for that, just, you know, having them to have to get washed and all of those things.
The first big hard one for me, and I feel like maybe it was for your dad too, is when we had to take his keys away when he couldn't drive anymore. And that, I feel like that's a hard one for all old people. It's like, you see old people who are bad drivers and you're like, somebody take their keys away. And then I remember the day we had to take my dad's keys away, and we were, I was like, oh, everyone who has someone old in their life, this is, you are taking away someone's autonomy.
You are. And you're taking away, like your father, my dad was also, you know, blue collar and a man's man, although very klutzy. He would trip over everything. And
same thing with my dad. My dad always said he had two left feet. He said he was really good at running a mile in a circle.
Our dad, I think the one thing that, you know, was the hardest was when we had to admit that he needed extra help and needed to go into a home. That was that for us was feeling like we failed. Like, you know, there's four daughters, he's got two ex-wives, there's so many people surrounding him, but because of the way we live this modern world and this modern life, it's hard to support the person. And with your father, because, you know, this disease had been lingering for so long, what was, you know, taking his keys away, you know, that was one of the hardest parts for you. What was the first sort of milestone in his disease where it really started to change your outlook on life, or really started to affect your daily routine because of what he needed, or, you know, whatever the revelation was?
From the second my dad got Parkinson's, I was like, well, I will be coming home all the time. For 18 years, I went home to Michigan almost, I probably went home minimum of 4 to 6 times a year. I was always home as much as I could be. Once it started getting really bad, I was home every other month.
I remember
that. I really truly believe one of the reasons I am not farther in my career is because I was always stopping and starting. I was always going home to Michigan. And it's like, yeah, I was like doing comedy in Michigan too. Sure. Blah, blah, blah. But that's when I can definitely say it affected any momentum I could have had in this business. It also really affected relationships that I have.
What changed for you? Like, what were the what effects?
First, there was the fact that just no one's as good as my dad. Just my dad is like, just, he was just like as good as they came. Just like, there really was no one, and there will be no one like my dad. Like, he just, he showed up for every single person. He was the guy who put his mask on for everyone else, put a mask on for everyone else before he would even think about putting it on for himself. And he lived that way to every person in his life and not just me. And I just, anyone I met, I'd be like, you're dog shit compared to my dad. Like, you would never be the man that my dad is.
And you're never. Just checking out at a grocery store.
The guy's like, I said paper or plastic. Like, I don't think you need to have an existential crisis, man. I'd be like, you don't understand. My dad would make a bag. Okay. He's like, just buy a bag, bitch.
Your doctor's like, this is a gynecology appointment. do you want me to call someone, or?
It really is like. Every man I met, I'd be like, you're just a shadow of a person.
And was your dad, tell me, walk me through like your relationship with your dad, like growing up, what were things you guys would do together? Like, did you have, first of all, you have siblings, correct?
I have an older brother.
Okay.
I have an older brother who, like, I was the tomboy. My brother was, and he did athletics. He was not an athlete. he showed up to team sports, but he wasn't like the sporty kid. Like, I was the sporty kid. So my dad was always like, whatever it was, like, he was like playing catch in the yard with me. He was like doing sports with me. Like, just like I was like my dad's buddy. I was always his, just like his partner in crime kind of thing. Like, and I was always, my dad was a quiet guy, and I've always just been a very loud personality. And my dad always just loved how weird I was. Just thought it was just great. Just like, what a kid kind of thing. Just really truly was like, just thought I was just the neatest.
Was he able to see you do stand up?
Never saw me do stand up, not once.
Fuck. Oh god.
But I'd come into his nursing home and I would just fucking crush. And I was just like, I would make everybody at the nursing home laugh. And then my dad would be like, she's a comedian.
Oh.
My dad was always proud of the way I walked through life. And it's funny, my dad died. My dad and his brother were kind of like, whatever, they weren't close. I don't want to go into it, but it's a long story. So I didn't really have much contact with my uncle. But when my dad died, I remember I got COVID, and my dad died in October. I got COVID in December. So I was fucking stuck at home, alone, depressed, just reeling from my dad dying and then like just being alone for fucking 2 weeks. And I reached out to my uncle at one point and I was like, hey, do you have any stories about my dad? And he's like, your dad was a weird guy. And I was like, was he? He's like, yeah. He's like, your dad would just like do his own thing. He was always just kind of doing his own thing. And then he told me this story about my dad and his brother were 4 years apart. And my uncle had started driving and he dropped my brother off at Hebrew school. So my dad grew up in LA. He went to Hollywood High, but he grew up at Sunset and Gower, pretty much. And the Hebrew school that he went to was on Hollywood Boulevard. So my grandparents dropped my dad off at Hebrew school that morning. And then they were like, they told his brother, they're like, go pick up Harold from Hebrew school. And so Kenny was like, all right, I'm going to go get him early. I'm going to go pick him up early. So he goes to Hebrew school. He goes inside. He goes to the desk. He's like, hi, I'm here to pick up Harold Schreiber. And they're like, who? He's like, Harold Schreiber. He goes to Hebrew school here. My parents dropped him off here this morning. They're like, we do not have a student here by that name. Sorry. My dad's brother was like, okay. And he like goes and sits in the car and he's like waiting for my dad. The bell rings and my dad comes out, gets in the car. And his brother's like, I just went inside. They don't even know who you are. What? My dad's like, oh yeah, I've never been to Hebrew school. I just walk in the front door and walk out the back door and then just walk around Hollywood Boulevard by myself.
How old was he?
12.
Oh, that's some beautiful stuff right
like
there.
Like he just rebellious. Rebellious, but not to make a point. He wasn't even being rebellious. Like he was just like this. I was just doing my own thing. And then they found out my dad had a secret job doing construction.
So at 12?
At like 14. So my dad would come home from school in high school. He would come home from school and then he would just like disappear into the neighborhood. And this was like at a time when like the whole idea, like be home by sunset kind of thing, like which no longer exists. It's like parents are like, wherever you are, you need to be home earlier than then you're going to get murdered. So my grandma was like, be home by sunset, blah, blah, blah. And then one day this guy shows up at the door and he's like, hey, is Harold here? And like an older man, construction worker. And he's like, is Harold here? And my grandma was like, no, who the fuck are you? He's like, oh, I work with Harold. She's like, you work with Harold? He's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, it's a construction site on blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, what? Come to find out, one day my dad was like walking in the neighborhood and saw a construction site. And I didn't know this. I love watching construction. I think it's the most fascinating thing in the world to watch a whole building go up. Like, it's just so cool to me.
Do you sit there for 6 months and watch the whole process?
I mean, would I get a job working at a construction site to get laid at this point? Absolutely.
Oh, what a good point. Holy hell. Yeah. I know.
I'm just sabotaging the construction site so it never gets built. I'm like, I'm just going to be here forever. So my dad walked by and was like, at one point they were like, hey kid, you want a job? And he's like, yeah. And they gave my dad a job working at this construction site and he was really good at it. And they like gave him like a real job. So my dad had this job. And one day, I don't know what it was, but he didn't show up for work and they were worried. So they went by my dad's house and they were like, is he here? And they're like, all right, well, just let Harold know when he gets home. We could we could really use him. And the construction guy was like, your son's like a huge asset. He's really good at what he does. And my dad just like had a whole side hustle going, never let anybody know about it. And that was just like kind of like my dad. He was just like, did his own thing, didn't really care what people thought. Not even in the way of like where I would be like, I'm weird. Like, I'm not doing what other people do, like making a statement about it. Like, my dad wasn't even making a statement. He was just like, I just don't do what people do.
He was just authentically individualistic.
Yes, extremely unabashedly just who he was, like, and it was in that moment that I realized that that's why my dad always liked me. My dad always liked me for that.
You are like that.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, whether that's a learned trait or something that is just this cosmic exchange of DNA, who cares? We don't need to know either way. You know, yeah. If my father was a very affable man, he loved making people laugh. His best friend was a stand-up comedian. He used to go on the road with him. My father would go just as a friend and support because he loved stand-up comedy. And my dad also would talk to every single human. You kind of touched on this with your father. My dad treated everyone equally with respect. If I could describe him to somebody, he was basically, I think he lived life wanting to make other people feel seen and better, genuinely, without any desire of getting anything from them. Mm-hmm. He just enjoyed joy. Mm-hmm. And he really loved being the brunt of the joke. He loved busting balls. Like, you know, we both have acquired these traits from our father. You know, I was the same. I was the tomboy of the four girls. I was his favorite. Yeah. You know, all these things.
Do your siblings know that you were his favorite?
It was the best. It was the running joke. Are you kidding me? It was the thing. And even, you know, down towards the end where, you know, he had to get bathed, they called me. They called me to come and bathe him because it was, the relationship was so different for them. Not that they didn't want to or, you know, felt like I should have to.
Siblings were like, this will be good for material. You let Jessamy do it.
Yeah. You definitely want to look right into your dad's dick hole. You know, you do. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Just get right in that urethra.
Get right in that. Get under the fromunder. Get near the nuts. You know, you want to.
The fromunda.
What was for you? There's so many questions that I want to ask you about going through the grief, because the one thing that's very, unique about having someone who has a neurodegenerative disease, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, Lewy body, any sort of dementia where the train is unstoppable, the grief process is much different. It's much specific and unique in that you're grieving them while they're alive.
Yeah.
And people who have...
The grief train takes off.
It takes off.
Way before.
Yeah.
And so you're simultaneously loving a person, helping a person, grieving with them and then grieving for them all at the same time.
And on top of that, living a life that's separate and parallel to them. Mm-hmm. So walk me through what that was like for you. How did you manage it? How did it break you down? And what did you do to cope through that?
Cope. I really like, I don't think I accepted, I mean, I knew he was going to die eventually. I mean, everybody dies, but I didn't know how it was going to look. I didn't know what it was going to be like. Like, I didn't talk about it a lot. I really never really talked about my dad to a lot of people. I never really cried about it to anybody.
During the process. I mean, it was a long process. It was a long time.
It was a very long time. I really didn't. It was one of those things. I'm really close with Ian Edwards. And Ian's the kind of person, like, if I ever called him about like anything going on in my life, he would make a joke about it. He would like tease me about it. But if I called him crying about my dad, like, that was the one thing where he wouldn't like make a joke, nothing. He would just sit there and like, just let me cry and just listen. And I could talk to people like you. Mm-hmm. I could talk to people who had been through having a sick parent. But I could never talk to just a normal person, even somebody who had like a dead parent. People would be like, oh, my parent had passed away. And it's like, it's not even close to being the same. It's like, I felt very alone. Mm. I felt like, not like no one understood what I was going through, because I knew there were people who did understand, but I just felt like I didn't even have the capacity to bring anyone into my life. I never dated anyone to the point where they saw my dad when he was sick.
Wow.
I had no serious relationship. I had one. I take that back. I had one. And it wasn't even when my dad was that bad. He had already had his brain surgery, so he was like, okay. And that guy met my dad. But like, as it really got worse, like, I never had friends over to the house when he was still living at home. Like, no one really saw him. I didn't really like let anyone into that world. Like, it was too sacred for me.
Were trying to protect yourself, or that you, was it a way to make it less real or keep it as real as you could for yourself?
I didn't want to put anyone in a position where they had to feel something that they didn't want to feel. I didn't want anyone to feel uncomfortable, like they didn't know what to say, because it's a hard thing. You don't know what to say necessarily. Like, I know what to say. I know how to treat a person who's, I never, ever treated my dad different. I never treated him like an invalid. Not once, never. Did I make fun of him the entire time? Absolutely.
I fucking
every
hope so.
Every single fucking thing. When he would, every single time he would start drooling, I'd be like, oh, you sprung a leak. I called him Old Faithful. And then sometimes he would start drooling to the point where I like was like trying to clean it up. I was like, you just keep drooling as I'm cleaning. And I would just shove a ball of Kleenex in his mouth. I was like, you need a gag, Dad. And like, I knew that I could treat him like that. And I didn't want anyone else to treat him any other way. Nurses treat you like a person. Nurses don't treat you like an invalid.
No, they don't.
And that's why I was always just comfortable being at his nursing home with the other nurses, with anyone else. Like, it was just always more comfortable for me to be around people who knew how to be around someone who was sick.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's just, it's like, it was too much for me to watch someone like fumble and like not know what to do.
Well, there's a shorthand with shared trauma and mm-hmm. an understanding of communication and how unsaid things can go further than the wrong said things or inappropriately said things, not yeah. meant in any ill will, just because of lack of experience.
Yeah.
For me,
and that's why, like, I would have brought you in to meet my dad in a heartbeat. I would have yeah. been like, well, she'll know exactly what to do.
Right. I feel the same way. With the nursing home scenario, my dad was in a memory care facility. I learned so much. I just being in that environment for the first time, you know, I really just watching it as an observer, as a comedian for one, you know, aspect, it was a totally new world. But as a daughter of somebody who was there, it was such a unique experience for me. You know, I learned just how much our elderly are tossed aside,
yep.
even from their own family. I learned the lack of available improved technologies for these facilities and how it's a real short sight in our society. So many things. My question is, having your dad in the facility, what were some revelations you had and, you know, maybe experiences or relationships with the nurses there? Like, what were things that you learned from that environment for you?
First of all, there are good nurses and bad nurses. Let's just get that out of the way.
We have to say that.
I'm not going to sit here and pretend like every fucking nurse is a goddamn fucking angel.
No, we can't say that. It's just not realistic.
I watched nurses be very impatient with elderly people. Majority of them, very kind, very caring, very much, you know, I don't know if nurses take the Hippocratic Oath, but I know doctors do, so I can assume nurses do as well. Very true to the Hippocratic Oath. We do discard our elderly, because I can't tell you how many times a nurse said to me, for a daughter who doesn't even live in the same state as her father. They're like, you are here more than daughters who live right down the street.
Ugh.
And I'm like, how can people do that? And I get it. People have lives. People have everything. But it's like, it takes a village to raise someone, and then it takes another village to let that person go gracefully. And that village is nurses. It's nursing homes. It's the activities they have for elderly people. It's, you know, the people who come in there, they get entertainment in the nursing home. It's amazing what they do. I remember there was one day they had this person come in who was helping everybody like put together stories where they could talk about their life. And I was like, this is the fucking best day ever. I was like, I can't believe I got to come in on this day. And everybody got to share, like somebody was writing it all down. And somebody got to, every person got to like share a story from their life. And there was one guy who was like sharing stories of like, you know, he knew Jimmy Hoffa. I mean, who knows if he actually knew Jimmy Hoffa?
Who cares? But, like, it's a great story.
He was sharing like Jimmy Hoffa stories, and he was just, you know, the idea of respect your elders. People don't have respect for elders anymore. They just don't.
Especially in this culture, in this society, I think.
In a culture where your weight and worth is determined by your social presence. There are kids who are 14 years old who have too much power and too much influence to care about whatever an elder person has to offer them. It's fucked up.
It is fucked up.
So fucked up that like kids will never realize until it's too late what they could learn from an older person.
And it's everything. It's experience, you know, it's what they've been through. It's those sort of hindsight based nuggets of wisdom that are only earned from living a life.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to have conversations like that one-on-one with your dad? That's the one thing I sort of really, it's just all those things you don't know about them.
Yeah.
The things you'll never know about them, the questions you wish you could ask them. I think about that so often for people, and I look at them and, you know, having this conversation about how we just discard our elders. Those are your moms. Those are your dads. Like, there's so many things that I'll never know about my dad because everyone's fucking dead who's in his life. You know, for you, were you able to be conscious of that and at least take advantage of knowing that the grief train was headed to one destination and ask him things and, you know, maybe have him tell you things that you always wanted to know?
Yeah. I feel like you and I might have been the same way as kids. I was the why kid. Why? Why?
Yeah.
Why? 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 I had to know everything. I was a fucking nosy little shitty kid who had to fucking, I eavesdropped on every person I possibly could. My first job out of college, my boss was like, you just can't help yourself. He's like, you will literally stand by anyone's door and listen to what's going on in there.
I can see you doing that.
Every single, I gotta know everything. And not even like I'm gonna use the information to like as like a way to like get up in a system or something. I just need to know everything. I just want to know everything. My dad was never a talker. He was never a sharer of information. There were little things he told me along the way. But he was always pretty like quiet, pretty stoic. But the best story, the best story I got about my dad was from his brother. And like, now I don't really talk to his brother anymore. And it's like, I'm like, God damn it. Like, I want to, what, maybe like a month ago, one of my dad's, this guy my dad worked with named Gene, who lived in Pittsburgh. So my dad was in the trucking business. He repaired trucks. Pretty much he was like he owned a company that repaired trucks right on the border of Canada and Detroit.
And so he was in the mafia moving cocaine. Good to know.
And so I kind of like, I always was like, I don't know what my dad does. People would be like, what does your dad do? I'm like, he's a trucker. I don't know. It was like, my dad was never like totally clear on what he did. He took me to work once on a weekend. He had to go pick something up. And he was in a very bad part of like Detroit. and there was a sign that said no lot lizards. And I was like, probably 12, 11 or 12. And I was like, what's a lot? And it was a lizard with lipstick. Yes. And it was like, And I was like, Dad, what's a lot? You have lizards? Like, what's a lot lizard? What are those lizards?
Can
like?
We get some?
And of course, I loved all animals. So I was like, it must be a really cute animal. Look at the thing. She got lips.
So cute.
And then my dad explained to me that they were hookers. And that was the one nice thing about both my parents is they would never like candy coat anything. They if I asked a question, I got the answer.
Yeah, if I
was
important.
If I was old enough to conceive of a question and my brain was already going in that direction, they'd give me an answer. And my dad was like, well, a lot lizard's a hooker. And while we were there, we drive past a car and a woman pops her head out of the car, spits out the door and goes back inside. And my dad goes, no, that's a lot lizard. He didn't explain to me what had just happened, but was like, that's a lot lizard. And then years later, I was able to figure out why she popped her head in and out of the car.
God, she was spitting cum.
Uh-huh. She had a hot load. But my dad was more of like a, you know, like if we were doing something and it like reminded him of something when he was a kid, if I tried asking my dad about something when he was a kid, he'd be like, I don't fucking know. He wasn't like one of the, like my dad knew I was like I'm like the family historian. I know every single thing about my mom's half of the family. I know the entire emigration process of escaping from Russia from the Cossacks during the pogroms of the, you know, the late 1800s. I know about all of that. I know where they went from where to where to where to where and how I ended up there today. Dad's half of the family, he'd be like, well, they were Polish and they left after World War I and then they made it. My dad was a cowboy. I was like, what the fuck's a cowboy? I always knew my grandpa was a cowboy. I don't know what the fuck a cowboy did. Was he like
on a horse?
On a like horse? A real cowboy? I don't know. To this day, I don't fucking know. Everybody was always like, Grandpa Joe is a cowboy. No one fucking knew a thing. I knew my dad had a pet tortoise. He's like, I love that tortoise. And then somebody stole it. And it was always like, my dad was very sad when his tortoise got stolen.
You sure it wasn't a lot lizard that got stolen from him?
That was the first case of sex trafficking. Right from my dad's backyard. My dad wasn't like a fucking storyteller.
Much of a talker.
This dude, Gene, he called me and he was like, your dad was the best. He was like, never could there have ever been a more honest guy than your dad. He's like, you know, your dad was so honest, he actually made himself go bankrupt. He's like, your dad was a terrible businessman. He's like, he couldn't fucking lie to anybody for anything. My dad just, and that's true. My dad went out of business, made himself, he went bankrupt. Just had no idea how to say, just tell a slight lie. If a trucker came in and was like, my car is doing this, my dad would be like, he'd be the guy who'd be like, have you tried turning it on and off? And like that would do it. Most people in business would be like, oh, you need X, Y, Z. You should get all these different things done. My dad would be like, I'm going to get you out of the door for the least amount possible. And that was my dad. Just not a good businessman, honest to a fault. But the guy Gene was like, he's like, and that is the reason why he's like my whole truck fleet. He's like, I had every trucker that went through Detroit go to your dad. No, he's like, I would never send them to anyone else other than your dad. And it's like, you know, it's like stories like that I'll hear now, you know, last time I saw Gene Hyler's his name. It was like when I was like 12. I don't fucking know. I was so young. But I'm going to New York. He's in Philadelphia. And I'm going to New York end of December. And he's like, I'm going to have one of my kids or one of my grandkids drive me to New York so I can come see you do comedy. Because I told him that my dad never saw me do comedy. And he's like, well, I'm going to come see you do comedy for your dad. And I was like, Gene, you're super Catholic.
You better buck up, buddy. You better not judge me for this shit.
Hate what I have to say.
You know, that's the one thing, not to rub it in your face.
Your dad saw you do comedy.
So much. He was the biggest. He was my biggest fan. He would do this thing just because he was beaming with pride where every time we were out, he would ask people, have you seen Girl Code? Do you know Girl Code? Or have you watched MTV? Well, this is my daughter. She's on it. She has a show. You should. He was just like promoting for me always. Always. Everywhere we went, he was telling
people.
He was
your hype man.
He was my hype man. And so, so proud of what I did. I think because essentially in somewhere in his mind, it was something he kind of wanted to do and was able to live vicariously through my, you know, my doing it. I know for me during the whole process, which was much shorter only because we didn't know decades before what was creeping in because the symptoms of Alzheimer's are just so creepy. And sometimes we write them off as dad being dad, or in society we've accepted dementia as a normal part of aging, which it's not. And Parkinson's certainly is not a normal part of aging. These are diseases. These are inflammatory diseases of the brain. With my dad, during the process from diagnosis to death, it was just a year of official diagnosis and him dying. But, you know, we had realized all the signs that we missed before. But for me, the survival of it all came in going home as much as I could, like yourself. And it also came in maintaining the relationship with my father as well, treating him the same, even though he wasn't there mentally towards the end as much as possible. But there was one moment, you're talking about lot lizards, that I remembered where my dad was getting reclusive because his brain was shutting off more and more and he was forgetting who everybody was. So he wasn't feeling so social because he was such a social butterfly naturally. And that was robbed of him in this disease. There was this one day where, you know, we'd go in and the nurse, there were days we'd go in with my sisters and myself and the nurses would just be like, he doesn't want to come out of his room. And we tried to sit with them and he just was so unresponsive to us. And it got really hard. And, you know, I was like, well, what can we do to get him out of his room so we can like get some circulation and walk around the facility? So I was like, let's tell him we got him a stripper. Like, I don't care. I don't care how much of your memory is destroyed. A man, the mind-dick connection cannot be severed.
Yeah. No, that's the last connection to go. That is literally the last connection. Every synapse can erode. Every single function of the human body. But on a man's last breath, that's why he takes his last breath. The second that connection is severed, a man's like, what's the point?
And so that we were having a consult with the nurses, you know, because it was sort of getting to the end where we had to like figure out hospice and all of that. And they're like, well, we're trying to get him out of his room. And I was like, go tell him we have a hooker. They're like, we can't do that. I was like, yes, you can. You can, and you will.
I'm giving you full permission. They're like, no, we'll get fired. And you're like, I don't care. Go tell him.
Yeah, that's great. We keep it in the room. Go tell my dad there's a stripper here. And they're like, well, I'd advise against it. I'm like, well, let's see. Let's just see. Let's see. If he doesn't, let's try it once. And if it doesn't work, I'll never ask you again. Just do it this one time. And so they go down.
And that's the story of how Jess and I became a stripper.
For my dad.
A daughter's love.
Is this our lifetime movie?
There is.
Stripped Down is the name of the lifetime movie. For
instead of Strip Peas, it's Strip Peas.
Yeah. Strip uppies. This motherfucker. So we're sitting there waiting. This motherfucker comes in with his walker with the biggest smile on his face.
He ready. He ready he's for like, titties.
And he's just looking around. He's like, where's a stripper? We all laughed. You know, I guess the point is that for me during the process, humor was everything. Humor was our connection.
Everything.
It was the way we communicated and we kept it that way through his disease. And like I mentioned before, the grieving process of this sort of disease is so unique. For somebody who's listening, people who are going through a similar scenario where they are having to grieve a person while they're alive, do you have any pointers, you know, some NAS pointers that you can give them that can help them survive through this ordeal?
Just accept the suck is really like, it sucks. Just accept it. Treat them like a person. Treat them like they're not sick. Give them their dignity as much as you can. They're not mentally incapable, like in the sense of like they're not dumb. Like they're still there. That person is still there and there. So treat them like that. Even though it might feel weird. Like I remember towards the end, man, my dad was like, there were days where I'd walk in, I'd be like, Dad, and I'd get like no response from him. And that was fucking hard. Cause usually I'd walk in and my dad would be like, even if he wasn't like verbal, he'd be like, like just pumped that I was there. And it was hard when I walked in and got no response from him. That was a hard, but I was like, all right, this is the moment where you just have to sit there and just physically be present. And that's a really big part of it, is just be there. Just be there. Just, you know, holding a person's hand, holding space for them. You know, it's like, talk to people who've been through it. Talk to people. Don't isolate. You know, like if I talk to so many, I can imagine you do too, but I talk to so many people on Instagram. I have so many Parkinson's friends.
I have so many Alzheimer's friends and doctors as well. I'm hounding everybody on a weekly basis.
And it's crazy. I just like, there's this one woman I met right before COVID. And she thought she was farther along in the process than my dad was. So she was like, anything you need to know, I'm here for you. And then I was like, same, you know, my dad, and she got the surgery. She's like, I'll totally tell you about it. I was like, no, I'll tell you about it. I'm the veteran here. And this was a young girl. She was like in her 30s. Young.
Oh, fuck.
And just had the brain surgery that my dad had. And it's like, I was supposed to go to New York the first week of lockdown, and then it got canceled, and I was going to meet her. We had just become Parkinson's friends. And it was really like, lean into the community that's online. That if there is one good thing about social media, and I fucking hate social media, it is the downfall of humanity. If there is one good thing about it, it is finding community for whatever your thing is, and do that. Don't isolate. Talk to these people. It could be the smallest, you know, most meaningless question you could think you have. Just fucking ask it. Just talk to somebody. Like, that's really all there is to it. Embrace the suck, find other people who are going through the suck, and then just, you know, life isn't short. Life is long.
It really is. Especially when you go through shit like that. You're like, bring on the short part, fucker.
Yeah, please. For the love of God.
For the love of God.
There was a point where my dad was like, go. My dad, I was cleaning pee off the floor. Of my dad's pee off the floor. And I was just like, this can't be how it goes. My dad can't be okay. My dad, by the way. Wait, did your dad ever have to have a condom catheter? The pee hat? The dick hat? Oh my God, my dad's dick was so small, it would not stay in the catheter. Just get popping off.
Oh God.
And then all of a sudden you'd see the sheet that they keep putting. My dad, I told you in my set that, anyways, my dad wanted to be naked all the time. And they'd put a sheet on him and he'd just fucking take the sheet off. But they put the sheet on him and then all of a sudden you'd see little like pee strip go. And I was like, oh, the catheter's off. Just peed that puppy right off. His little dick wouldn't stay inside the catheter. Fucking. I truly believe. I got off stage the other night and a girl came up to me and she was like, I had no idea that what I went through with my parent was universal.
That's the point. That is, for me, like watching you talk about your dad's dick, I was like, oh God, thank God. You know, I know you've been through stuff, but I just was so happy that someone else was taking a creative step in a courageous step to discuss something that people are A, going to be shocked by, but not shocked in a salacious sense, just shocked in a reality sense that this is something that you had to go through. And then B, people who have been through it are going to feel less shocked and feel like they have a community. And that, to me, that's my focus. That's all I'm focused on now, is just allowing people to know you might have to look at your dad's dick. You might have to wash your mom in her private parts, and it's going to be fucking horrible. There's no way to sugarcoat washing your dad's dick. And like hearing you talk about experiencing your own dad's dick, it honestly, I was like, I just let out like a sigh. Like there was some healing in that. Even just as a peer.
Don't get me wrong. I will not forget your flex when you said your dad had a big dick. So
I'm sorry. I had to let you know that. I felt like it posthumously, Italians,
you know? what can you do? He's got a fucking, how do you say eggplant in Italian? He had a big eggplant.
Mouillon.
He had a big eggplant.
Mouillon.
If you don't laugh, it's as you know, the dad jokes are, it's a hard sell. So it I started doing this thing sell. Where I'm like, listen, you guys, what we're about to get into might be a little weird, but you got two options. You can be sad about it, or you can laugh about it. I mean, why not laugh about it? Like, I'm not, and I hate it when people are like, you can see people judging you for talking about your dad's dick. I just want to be like, I'm the one who helped my dad.
I'm the one who was in the shower. Like,
did you help your parent when they were sick?
Right. By the way, when the day you have to help them, you're going to think about this.
Yeah, you're going to think about this. The other day, a woman goes, I go, did you take care of your dad when he was sick? She's like, no. And I was like, oh, what? You were rich enough that you just had nurses full time and you didn't have to lift a fucking finger? Okay, cool. Well, you know what? We all didn't have the luxury of having full-time care for our parents, you know?
And it's the most expensive. These types of diseases are the most expensive. We're talking upwards of $40,000 a month.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Of just minimum basic care.
Bare minimum. You will not find anywhere, and I know because we looked everywhere, you will never find anything cheaper than $6,000 a month for any sort of extended care for a parent.
Right.
There is nothing cheaper than $6,000.
There's nothing cheaper.
And if you don't have it, you're taking care of them at home.
While you're also trying to live your life.
Uh-huh. And that ain't cheap.
It's not cheap.
And by the way, the best life you can give them, by the way, isn't keeping them at home.
No.
The best life you... There are nursing homes. There are really good nursing homes that have things for them to do that you will never be able to give them that much access and have a life.
That's one of the only ways, and the unfortunate truth is that people feel a shame and guilt about not being able to take care of their loved ones. And there is this, economic discrepancy where if you are rich, they're going to get better care. That's just the reality of this scenario. And to not feel guilty about that, to not feel guilty, you know, even if you are somebody who has to stay home and do that, which is just such a I think it might be, when I think about things I've experienced in life, the most difficult thing to do is to care for someone like that in that capacity. It's so, the emotional weight goes both ways for the person being cared for and the people caring for them. And also puts a lot of strain on the family. So many arguments,
so many resentments. Like, that was a rough period for my brother and I when everything was happening with my dad, when his sickness started to like escalate. Like, my brother works at Apple. He's like, you know, very successful. So it was always on me to like, Nicole can put down her non-job. Like, nobody saw what I did as being a comedian. It's not a real job. Yeah. So it was like, it was on me to come home all the time. It was on me to come home for months at a time. So it was like, I was in the luxury. And then my mom would give me shit being like, you know, you need to get a real job. I'm like, you want me to get a real job? Do you want me to get a real job? Because if I have a real job, I'll lose it if I come home as much as I do. I will get fired from whatever it is I do. So yeah, was I a vendor at Costco going? I took a job working at Costco as a vendor so I could go work at the Costcos in Michigan.
I did not know that.
Yeah. This job allowed me to go to Michigan. I did this for 2000, I think 2015 to 2018.
Holy fuck. I had no idea.
Uh-huh. I was a skincare, I worked for a skincare company, and they would fly me home. They would fly me to Michigan, minimum 4 times a year. And I would go and work at the Costco in Michigan, the different Costcos in Michigan, selling cream. So I could go home for free. I could stay at home, and then I could spend time with my family. I specifically took that job because I knew it would allow me to work at the Costcos here in LA and California, but it would allow me to go home and work at the Costcos there.
It is interesting when you go through these scenarios where everyone's stress is so heightened and you never know how people are going to react, and you know, family members each grieve differently. It brings up so many issues within the family structure. And it's important. I think that's important because that's where it gets real. That's where you realize where your all of your individual ceilings and bases are, and how to sort of respect one another on a different level, because we're all coming together, but we're also having these individual experiences that mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense to go, well, I'm doing it this way, why can't you do it this way? And I mm-hmm. remember a specific instance when I had come home, and this was early on before we were able to put him anywhere. And, you know, my sisters, you know, I was doing the same thing. I was flying home as much as I could in between doing road work and doing stand up and trying to make sure I'm able to survive and pay for my life and come home as much as I could. I was home just every other month for the most part, maybe even more during that year. And I remember during the holidays of that first year, it was pandemonium for them, you know, my sisters, because we didn't have a full diagnosis. People were doing shifts taking care of him. We had an in-home nurse. We just were plugging holes. My sisters were just there plugging the holes of the sinking ship, which we didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. And I had come home. It was like Thanksgiving, and he's up and having this restlessness that sort of happens sometimes with the disease where the brain is firing and shutting, and he has no real leverage of reality. So he wants to sit, and then he wants to stand up. And so there's this restlessness that has to be managed on Thanksgiving. You know, it's festive and there's food being cooked. And here's my dad having to go to the bathroom, not having to go to the bathroom, pooping his pants. And then I need to go, you know, all this. And I just remember walking in, I had just gotten there, and this is going on, and I'm new to everything that's happening, kind of, because I'm coming back and going home, and I fly home, and then I go back to LA, and I come back, and he's a totally different person. Each time I come back,
the timeline keeps getting farther down. Yeah.
Oh my God. A chunk of him is gone. And I'm like, well, I have a learning curve here. And so I come home, my dad's having this panic attack, and my sister's there, and one of my sisters, and she goes, well, you're home, you can deal with it now. And I just remember being like, oh, I know this is your process. I know this is how you're dealing with it, but to communicate with me like that really makes me want to dig a grave and shove you the fuck in it alive and bury you underneath piss-soaked sand.
Yeah.
That's how I felt in that instance.
Dad's piss-soaked sand, by the way.
Yeah, have dad pee on top of
I'm going to take dad's urinal, and then I'm going to use that pee.
But it's just such a, you know, I think the point is, for anybody listening, to know that everyone's experience of it is so individualized that I was mad at her, and we definitely had a moment, but I also understood that she was having
She was at the end of her rope. She was at the end of her rope for that day.
Yeah.
And it's a day-to-day thing. It is a day-to-day. Your frustration with it is going to ebb and flow. There are going to be some days where you're just like fully accepting of it. And then there's other days where you're going to be like, someone saying, excuse me, when they come in the room will set you off to the point where you want to fucking just scour their body with sanitary hand. I don't know what I'm saying.
Yes, but like, no, yeah, all of that.
Murder them.
Yeah. And then in the same breath, there's those days where you're so beaten down where someone goes, how are you today? And you're just like,
yeah, you just cry. Just cry.
You're just bawling.
You will. Everything is, you feel bipolar kind of in that, like,
oh my
your emotions don't feel like your own. You don't know where they're coming from. It could be like joy. It could be you, It's an emotional roller coaster. It really is. There is nothing. Death is fucking gross. It's just there is absolutely.
Death is
gross. We all
gross.
Fucking die, by the way. We all fucking die. And like, by the way, this whole experience, there is nothing that has prepared me more for the thought that I want to die on my own accord. Like, I want to kill myself. I will not let death come to me. I will go to it.
And I think you have that right. You know, I think every individual has that right. It's an interesting thing. Your relationship with death really evolves as you face it with ones you love so much. And your whole ideology about the end really evolves. And I think, you know, having the perspective of grieving somebody when they're alive really has made me endeared to the fragility of life itself and in everyone's individual experiences and me not taking anything personal, you know. It also it makes me open to people like you where, yeah, we know each other, we're in the same industry and we're rolling around and, you know, we'll say hi and all that shit, but there's a deeper level to it. Like, I revere you in such a different way than other comedians because of your journey, because of what you've been through. Like, I feel like you and I are in this community together. Mm-hmm. And you know, I appreciate you because you've reached out to me during when my dad was sick and all of that. So I just wanted to like say how much I appreciate you and honestly appreciate you being open to being open talking about your dad. Cause I know you said this isn't something that you, during the process that you were talking a lot about, even though now you've, you know, you're putting it into your art, which I think is important.
I won't even talk about it. Like as far as a conversation goes, I will not talk about it with anybody who hasn't really been through it or is about to go through it kind of thing. Like there are comedians, I won't say who, because I don't know if they want to go public with their journey with their parents' sickness, but like they've come to me and I'll talk to them. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't want to talk about my everything with my dad with that many people. Like, I just, it's just not worth it to me. And like, I've always just thought, I just love that you are just a brass balls, like, don't give a fuck kind of person. I loved, I was so sad to see you go through what you went through, but the grace you had going through it and the way you honored your dad and the love you showed for him every step of the way made me love you so much. And like, you're a good fucking woman. And your dog is so cute.
My dog heard you crying and they thought like there was some words being said. They're like, hold on, let me come to the rescue. I appreciate that.
Bitches be crying.
That was, you know, like I said before, I didn't know what to do. I did the only thing I thought I could was, which was just to document and share it and hope that other people going through it weren't feeling as alone as I was, and you know, utilizing what little skills that I had in this world for the common good of people, you know. Well, I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you sharing. Where can my listeners find you, listen to you, stalk you? You have any shows coming up?
Podcasts? When is this coming out?
This will be out next week.
Okay, well, I'll be all next week. I'm doing the Comedy Cellar in Vegas. So if anybody is in Vegas, baby, I'm there. There's two shows a night. I'm there from the 25th to the 31st. So that'll be fun. And then I'm featuring for Nate Craig at the Creek in the Cave the first weekend in November in Austin, Texas. I'll be in December. I'll be in New York City. After Christmas that week, I'm doing Carolines with the Tell.
Oh, David, that's gonna be so awesome.
I'm trying to think of like fun big ticket items. Oh, I'm doing Cobbs with in San Francisco with Jessica Michelle. We're co-headlining December 1st, I think it is. Just look on their calendar, it's somewhere around there. And then yeah, those are kind of like, and then I'm at the Comedy Store all the time. And yeah, and that's pretty much it. I have a podcast called Two Filthy Nerds with Jessica Michelle Singleton. We're currently doing the Marvel Universe. We just got done doing Harry Potter and Indiana Jones. And then
fucking nerds.
And then, yeah, that's it. On the social media, at Nicole Amy, Twitter. I like jokes. Love. I just trying to be silly and have a good time. So.
Well, I love you so much. Thank you.
I love you so much.
Guys, I'll put links to find her in the show notes. And I appreciate you. I love you.
I love you so, so much. Now, how do I just hang up and leave and that's it?
Well, yeah, but just make sure you grab my head on the way out.
Oh.
I bet you're so sad you can't grab it.
Guys, really, truly, I cannot emphasize enough. Don't fucking touch her when you see her if you ever meet Justin and I. Like, it's not your position. It is my position. To hold her head. It is precious. It is round. It is a perfectly shaped head.
I love to be cradled by you. I can't wait to be cradled by you soon. I'm sure I'll see you somewhere.
I want to fucking
and I'll fall into your bosom.
You. And you're so tiny. I just want to like just consume you. I want to shove you and your perfectly shaped head into my pussy. I want to crush your skull the way it should have been crushed when it came out of your mom. Like, were you cesarean?
Really,
were you cesarean?
I was.
That's why your head's perfectly shaped. You don't have a forceps head.
You know what's crazy? You know what's crazy is I was born with an egg head, even though I wasn't passed through the birth canal.
And then how did it shape normal again?
They just kind of rolled me around like a piece of dough on the ground until it evened out.
Like a real Italian. They're like just
like a little fucking little pizza dough.
like a garlic knot.
Just a little meatball, huh? A little meatball.
A little meatball.
I love you, bitch.
I love you, bitch.
Bye.
Bye.
We're gonna ask some questions here from fans, and obviously, like you said, there a lot of them are foot based. Frank Tyler N9876, will you do some Lind of Love Her Feet podcast again? What does that mean?
No more. Love Her Feet. It's I used to have my foot fetish podcast. No, I won't do it. It's done. It's over.
Oh, done.
That phase in my life is gone.
I think it's good to just tap in and tap out.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It is. I tapped in, and when I saw the way, I saw firsthand how porn stars are treated by their fans, and they think they're these honorable, like nice guys. They're like, we worship them. Sure, if that's what you want to call it, worshiping. Sure, yeah. I've seen enough. I've seen a lifetime of enough.
Yeah,
and I haven't
good.
Even seen that much. I'm like, I'm good. Like, yeah, I'm so entirely disgusted
by how sure. women were treated. And that was just the surface, you know, you're like
that
looking
was just
at
the
it
surface.
From,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't
it's
even
a dark
imagine
hole.
How dark it gets. And, you know, sex workers are humans.
They are
people.
And it's one of the oldest
who are entitled
careers.
To their own space, their own lives, their own bodies. You do not own them. They owe you absolutely nothing. They owe you nothing. And to all of those fans who, you know, you subscribe to their OnlyFans and you have this level of entitlement to them now because you go fuck yourself. You fucking simp bitches. There's some good ones. There's some good people in there, but for the most part, I'm like totally disgusted by it and will never go back to working in that world again.
Well, it's good to have the perspective and know like what the fuck they were going through. Mm-hmm. M Faka Music. Who complains more, Bobby Lee or Eric Griffin?
Bobby Lee, probably. I feel like Bobby.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like Eric's probably, now that he's engaged to a Jewish woman, he might pick up some bad habits.
I think he's complained less now that he's gotten engaged. I think he's like...
Yeah, 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 because she's doing all the heavy lifting.
Yeah, she's got this beautiful fiance, and now he's okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She got a big ring on. She's literally doing the heavy lifting. She's literally. Like, I can't. I don't know how to get around. Yeah, so Bobby Lee. Bobby's a fun complainer, though. He is. If you're going to complain, you can be a complaining person, but if you're not fun, we all hate you.
Yeah, I mean, Bobby, he likes to antagonize. Mm-hmm. He enjoys antagonizing people, and he's a rabble-rouser.
Mm-hmm. He's great.
You know, that's why he's always taking his pants off.
Yeah. Oy. Whoa. I know. I've seen his butt so many times.
Smooth skin. Very smooth. So smooth.
He really is like a porpoise.
He's just the smoothest. He's like a baby. He's like a man mm-hmm. baby.
Mm-hmm. He's a maybe.
He's a maybe. Gregster B 86. What fetishes do you like men to have? That's an interesting
me. I want to be their fetish.
Yep. Sign, sealed, delivered.
That's it. That's all. That if you have a fetish, it's me.
Yeah, be obsessed with me. Why is that so much to ask?
I don't want you to reduce me to my feet. I don't want you to reduce me to my ass. I want you to reduce me to me. I am it.
Yeah, the full.
I want every fucking centimeter of me to be your fucking fetish.
I think that's a beautiful thing. I think it's a beautiful thing to want as a woman. Because mm-hmm. you know every piece of you is worthy of being fetishized.
Yeah.
Fetishized.
Like, I want you to, when you're jerking off, I want you to be like, oh my God, there's this piece of her ear that I love. And then everything. I want every part of me to be something that you're just like, you can't get enough of.
You hear that, Greg? Slucy Grant, without even looking, I know it's going to have to do with poop. I didn't look at every single question. She loves sending me videos of women crapping their pants, and I don't know why.
It's a woman who's doing this?
Oh, she loves it. Yep. She sends me videos of women filling their pants. Here we go. Have you ever loaded your pants as an adult? See?
Yeah. How many times? I mean, I don't even know how many times I have. Like, it's been so many times. Have you really
shit your pants often?
Oh, I have IBS. I've shit my pants a fucking million times. I shit my pants
in public
a month ago. Yeah. I shit my pants in my car. I've shit my pants in my car twice in my life.
You shit your pants a month ago?
Mm-hmm.
Where were you?
I was home. I mean, I was in my apartment.
Oh, that's good. Well, why didn't you get to your toilet? Were you just kind of like,
I mean, it was more of a gamble and a lose kind of situation. Like, fart.
Fair enough.
I mean, that's, I gotta be honest. Most of the times I've shit in my pants. There was one time I went on a hike and I just couldn't get back fast enough. I took a bear scat. I put the key in the front door and all of a sudden it was like, and I was like, damn it, I was so close. And I was wearing thong underwear, which are always the worst thing when it comes to shitting your pants, because the poop will find the path of least resistance, which is out the sides. And it's just, even though your pants are like holding everything in, you can feel it just go, and then your butt cheeks get wet. Take that, Slucy. You like that? You like that fill up? It doesn't fill up when there's a fucking thong split in the river.
No, it's like a knife. It's just a knife slicing the loaf.
Uh-huh. Oh, nice.
Love all
knife
of me.
Slicing the loaf. Poetic.
Flux Biota. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this.
She's okay, actually cool. This artwork. She did this one, and that one.
Oh, well, they're fun. She looks like she does artist. Drugs.
She's fucking awesome. But Flux does. If anybody wants any fucking super cool artwork, I have so much of her stuff around my house.
I was actually admiring that. I don't know. Is it Eeyore over your shoulder? I was like, who's
that's the Squatty Potty. It says awesome. Squatty Potty National Pie Day. My roommate is an asshole, and that's Buddy.
What is her favorite toe? I feel like this is insider info.
Yeah, it's insider info. I my second toe, my toe next to my big toe is longer. I have the longer second toe. And I think that's like a sign of intelligence. So of course I'm just holding on to that with dear life.
100%. I have the same thing, and it's a sign of genius. It's actually a genius. It's a sign of genius.
Cool.
I just watched my dog take an avocado off of my table.
Good.
Okay.
I don't know at what point I should tell you, but dogs can't eat avocados.
Oh, this motherfucker peels it and eats it like he's a fucking chef.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is he single? I've always wanted to date a chef. I want to date a guy who's good in the kitchen.
He's a rescue, so I don't know how
he's
you
like,
feel about
it. Spoons it out.
Yeah. All that's left is a full skin avocado in the pit, and the meat is gone. Every time. This motherfucker loves avocados. Tokyo Boys Club, will you have Jessie Mae as a guest on the Love Her Feet podcast? Well, as you heard in the beginning of this, that's no longer.
More. Yeah.
That's so no longer.
I won't have her.
No, she's
and
not.
If you guys
want to
see pictures of her feet, you can politely ask her for them and then pay her a fucking lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's asked me. And I'm like, sure, for monies. I need monies. Yeah.
The monies. All the monies.
I need all the monies.
Don't settle for less than $1,000. Oh, I remember one time a guy, I emphasized a million times, I'm not a foot fetish person. I'm not a foot fetish person. And everyone's like, how much can I pay you for a picture? I'm like, 1,000. And they're like, what? People in porn don't even ask for that much. And I'm like, well, I'm not a person in porn.
Right.
That's my premium. Do you want it or not? Don't argue with me.
I'm not asking you to buy the photo.
Swap meet, bro. Okay. Yeah. That's the fucking price. You pay yay or nay. Otherwise, be on your fucking simpy little way, you bitch.
Yeah, how bad do you want to see these feet? You have to pay the premium.
Yeah.
I have a theory about people who like feet. I think guys who like feet secretly are kind of gay because all the toes look like little peenies.
It's a good one.
They look like little teeny penises.
I will agree with you on that.
The little dick toes. And they're like, mm-hmm. Oh, they don't want to commit to the full dick. So they chop it up into little pieces of it.
Uh-huh.
And then they don't want to commit
dicks,
to it.
10 little dicks. 10 little dicks equal a whole dick.
Yeah, 10
little dicks.
All of a sudden, I want a hot ham listening to you sing that.
Dude, I love honey baked ham where it has that crust on the outside. Oh, I love it so much.
You know, the only time I like ham is during the holidays. Really, any other time, I'm like, this is disgusting. But when it's associated with like nostalgia, I'm like, this is delicious. Yeah. This reminds me of like when my mom had a family and then my dad had another family and there were 4 houses I had to go to on the holidays and I really miss it.
By the way, anybody who's like, it's so hard having divorced parents, I was like, you have more than one place to eat.
It's amazing.
It's a buffet.
So many
gifts.
Yeah, there's so many meals. So many people arguing and chaos. It was great. It was the best.
Amazing.
Well, you and I could talk for hours. I appreciate you hopping back on to do some Q&As. And I'm going to toss this on the Patreon. This is just going to be extra credit for my Patreon fans.
Yeah.
You guys want to hear the full
episode.
Especially
those foot fetish fuckers.
Yeah, you FFFs.
You listen foot to the full fetish episode fuckers. Go get
on, it. On Apple, and you'll know where to find her on the notes of the Apple episode. So I love you.
I love you.
Bye.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.